Good morning. This is Morning Edition on Vermont Public Radio. I'm Mitch Wertlieb. The student population in Vermont is trending decidedly downward. Since peaking at 107,000 students in 1997, the number of students in the Green Mountain State has fallen to around 88,000 today. Yet it's been pointed out that the number of teachers and staff in the state remains the same. While some small schools have closed over the last few years, many are still operating with fewer and fewer students. And while property tax rates have emerged as a theme in this and recent legislative sessions, Vermont's Education Secretary Rebecca Holcomb has raised questions beyond the cost to taxpayers for maintaining smaller schools. She's concerned about the quality of education in the schools with the smallest enrollments. We're looking at those ideas all this week in VPR's series Declining Enrollment, and Education Secretary Rebecca Holcomb joins us now from our studios in Norwich. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, this controversy seems to me at least counterintuitive in some ways. I mean, people from larger cities, for example, they might look at smaller schools and say, why are you complaining? And this is ideal to have smaller class sizes. It's better for teachers and controlling the class. They get more direct interaction with students. You know, big city schools are so overcrowded. What is wrong with having smaller schools in Vermont?
I don't think there's anything wrong with having smaller schools in Vermont, and I think it's actually something that people value. It's certainly something that people look for. I think the question is how small, and is there a too small? One of the challenges that we see is that with this declining enrollment that you referenced at the beginning, because we have a per pupil tax formula, the access to resources that districts have and schools have to support their educational programming declines when their student numbers decline. And they're really pushed into a situation where they have to make cuts. And if you're a big school of 400 kids, for example, it's easier to adjust your staffing in response to declines in enrollment. But when you're a very, very small school, you begin to cut programs that people really think of as integral to our school experience, things like foreign language. National research really thinks of 200 as a small school. It doesn't think of 40 as a small school. We're not really small schools by national standards. We're really what we would call micro schools.
So every time talk turns to small schools or school consolidation, as you were just discussing, some people get a little tense because they want to retain local control, and they might even have an emotional attachment to their local school. Maybe they went to that school themselves. What would you say to people with those concerns?
The argument that I hear most earnestly from our communities is if we lose our small elementary school, we'll lose our community. But I think the challenge is when you've already lost 75% of the students who are enrolled in your school, you know, you're already in a challenging position. And then the real question is, how do you provide for educating your children in a way that gives them opportunity and access to the kinds of learning they need to be able to be successful and stay and work and thrive as members of communities, as citizens, and in economic life so that we have a future as a state? Because if we so degrade the opportunities we provide our kids, we're really not viable either as communities or as states. And I think that's the challenge.
Secretary Holcomb, your agency released a report recently saying that bigger school districts provide better educational quality to students. I think you were just speaking to some of that. And the legislature is considering requiring districts to have at least 1,100 students. Can you talk about the difference, though, between larger school districts and larger schools themselves? I mean, why is having a larger district important?
I think that's a really important point. And we understand how people feel about their local buildings. But there are a lot of costs that go into just operating as a single district, a school district. Almost 70% of our districts have an average daily membership smaller than 300 students. And 30% of our districts actually have a membership of 100 or fewer students. And 21% of our schools have enrollments of 100 or less. And those very small districts with very few kids have all the same obligations under federal policy and state policy that very large systems do. For example, a very small district with only 20 students in it still has to pay for a separate single district audit at the same time as they're struggling to maintain breadth of offerings and things like arts.
What is a district audit, if I can just interrupt?
It's a financial audit that basically ensures that your district is managing funds in ways that are consistent with federal requirements to be eligible for federal funding, including special education funding and state funding. And that audit is being conducted in every single district in the state of Vermont. And when I hear stories like that, what I think is, gee, think of how much art you could buy for $8,000. Instead, we're going to tie it up in auditing. if this district, which is in a supervisory union with a number of other similarly sized districts, you know, had one school board but made a regional district that embraced all these small schools, they could move some of those district costs up a level and share them with others. And that would free up a tremendous amount of resources to actually support schools and classrooms, which is where we really want to spend our dollars. Instead, we're spending it on overhead.
Well, that report that you recently released says elementary schools work best at about 300 to 500 students, high schools at their best between 5 to 900 students. And if that is the optimal high school size, let's say between 5 and 900 students, can Vermont ever really get there? I mean, we currently have some high schools with just 55 students in them.
I think it's really important to qualify that those numbers are based on national research on school effectiveness. Obviously, in Vermont, that's not a realistic target for some communities. I think it does beg the question of whether a high school of 55 or 60 students can effectively really provide the range of opportunities that we need to be able to provide our students. I think it's important to remember that not making a choice on governance is making a choice. There are parts of the state that are currently, I think, on the brink of closure. And the public one is Concord, which is now looking at closing its high school. But certainly we are hearing from other small towns where their choice is either to close or to forge some kind of partnership with a neighboring town. And that's something that exists independently of anything the agency does or the legislature does.
You know, you mentioned school choice, and it seems that it's something that's implemented very regionally in Vermont. Some towns send their students to a specific private school on taxpayer funds because that's the choice their district has made. Some towns send students to any school they want, public or private. Other students can only apply through their public school to go to another public school. They may or may not be able to change schools. I mean, why isn't there a more unified system regarding school choice throughout Vermont?
You know, we think of it more as tuitioning. And if you look at the history of Vermont and you look at where the towns that tuition are situated within the state, what it really points to is that we're really two states. We're a more urban state that sort of hovers around the Chittenden County area. And then we're a highly rural state where towns have never had the population levels to really support their own community high schools. And so the way we educated our children historically was through what we called historical academies. These were public schools with a different form of governance, was the way they were referred to in statute. And children often traveled to the school and boarded to the school for the week and then came back to their rural communities at the end of the week. These are the ones that are well known. It's Burn Burton, it's St. Johnsbury, Linden. Bellows Free used to be an independent academy and it's since gone public. But the variation that you described is really a legacy of that tradition, that historical tradition.
Is it serving the state well, though, those different choices and the different ways it's spread around?
You know, I guess that there'll be as many answers to that question as there are people in Vermont. You know, when we look at the performance data for the high schools, the historical academies and the public high schools, the actual performance data is statistically equivalent. There's no difference in tested outcomes for students from these two kinds of systems. So I think arguably you could say that they're both good choices and that whichever model you're in, you seem to be getting comparable amounts of education, at least in English, language, arts, and math. This problem of rising tax rates and costs is a shared problem. It really doesn't matter what kind of system you've picked. We are all feeling this pressure around funding and supporting education.
Secretary Holcomb, you mentioned that in some ways Vermont is really two states, the urban state and the more rural state, and a lot of the rural parts of Vermont struggle with poverty, and I wonder what kind of grade you would give Vermont schools for meeting the needs of its lowest income students.
I actually think we have a fair amount of work to do. When I look at the research on children in poverty and school outcomes and achievement gaps, when kids are in school, they hold their own. The schools seem to keep them learning and growing. Where students lose ground is when they're out of school. It's in the summer months and it's after school, particularly in the elementary years. So when I see schools choosing class sizes of six over, for example, a summer program that continues learning throughout the year, I do question our commitment to equity. We need to be addressing these gaps. We know that child poverty is rising in the state. We know that the children in protective custody are younger than ever before. About 41% of them are between the ages of 0 and 5. As of this month, we had over 100 infants under age 1 in custodial care. The problem with this is we know these early years are absolutely critical to developing the social, emotional, and the self-regulation and the executive function skills that children need to succeed, whether it's in school or in life. I think Vermont is ripe for a really, really hard conversation about what it means to really serve and protect some of our most vulnerable children. And one of the indicators that we've been worried about is that Vermont is now the state with the highest proportion of children who are eligible for services for being emotionally disabled. You know, children of opiate-addicted parents or children who are really living in extremely difficult financial circumstances, these are the children who are most at risk of developing these emotional disabilities down the road. We need to figure out a way to prioritize that so that we can put our resources where they're going to matter and make it possible for these children to arrive at school ready to learn so that we aren't remediating and trying to fix problems after they're already created. So I do think we need to have a hard conversation as a state about what equity really is, whether providing equal resources to towns based on, you know, proportional to pay is enough, if that's really going to achieve our equity goals, given the fact that we are an increasingly stratified state with a growing proportion of our students living in poverty.
Education Secretary Rebecca Holcomb, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
And our series continues tomorrow with a look at small schools that are fighting to stay open.